This report is part of WNPR's Mental Health Reporting Series, made possible by our founding partner, Hartford Healthcare Behavioral Health Network.
This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, a special program recorded live on stage at the Bushnell in Hartford for the Connecticut Forum. The program was called An Honest Look at Mental Illness and featured three big thinkers on the subject, answering questions from me and from the sold-out audience at the Bushnell. This program is helping us kick off a new mental health reporting project this year. You can also see a TV special of the forum premiering on CPTV tonight. Go to cptv.org for more information. My guests on the panel were Andrew Solomon. He's a writer, psychologist, and mental health advocate. Dr. Kay Redfield Jamison, who's a professor in mood disorders at Johns Hopkins and co-director of the university's Mood Disorders Center. Dr. Hank Schwartz, psychiatrist-in-chief for Hartford's Institute of Living and vice president of behavioral health at Hartford Hospital. I want to start with just some basics, and I want to start with you, Hank, and maybe you can define what we're talking about when we say mental illness, because in the conversations beforehand, I heard a number of times this idea of mental illness versus mental health, and even the way we use these words. What is mental illness to you?
You'd think it would be a simple starting point, but I think it's as complex as it is, and it befuddles us so much, because our thinking about mental illness, while it has moved into the field of biology, and we understand illness to be a biologic disorder, and I've been making the argument we have to put it up alongside of heart disease and cancer, and consider it just that and expend the same amount of resources and attention and energy. And yet, the biology of mental illness and our awareness of it is not a satisfying explanation of the person and personhood when illness occurs. That person stands separate and apart, unlike the person who is ill with cancer and with heart disease. We understand those biologic disorders as purely biologic. We don't see them as occurring as the result of person or personhood. We're left viewing the mentally ill in this stigmatized way, because if it's the person, then it's person, it's personality, it's behavior that is that's under control. I think that's really where the question leads us to.
Well, I'll ask Kay to expand on that definition for us.
As much as I'm hesitant to endorse like the diagnostic systems that exist because they're so flawed, in fact, mental illness probably is best defined by saying there are a series of mental illnesses that I think probably everyone would agree are significant in terms of the impairment in life, the ability to function well, and the ability to think clearly, to cope, basically. And it impairs your way of going through life. It's not an illness if it's not affecting your ability to function in the world.
It's impairment. It's impairment in your ability to live.
That's part of it, yes, and it's also great suffering. I think mental illness implies a certain pain and discomfort, certainly in the major mental illnesses, a lot of pain and a lot of suffering. And with that goes something as radical and desperate as suicide.
What's the difference between being sad and being a little depressed and having severe depression?
I think depression lies on a continuum with ordinary sadness and pain and withdrawal. I always say that the opposite of depression is not happiness, but vitality. And when someone is severely depressed, what they lose is the vitality. It's the will to live. It's the energy to do things. It's the ability to engage themselves with the business of life. It's not just that they feel really, really sad the way that someone does who's experienced a loss and is going through grief. When you ask about the distinction between depression and ordinary sadness or ordinary grief, I sometimes think that it's, you know, you talk about a fence that's rusting, and you would use the same word rust if the fence had a couple of little orange spots on it, and you would also use that word if it had crumbled into nothing but powder. And it's the same phenomenon, and it's happened to the same fence, but they're two very different situations. And one of them you can probably fix with a lick of paint, and in the other, there's nothing there to fix. It's a gradual blurring where it goes from being a normal set of moods and circumstances to being something completely intolerable, unlivable, unmanageable, devastating, and paralyzing.
So, Hank, talk about that, but and how do we see that in patients? How do we manage that in patients who come to you?
The continuum between the signs and symptoms of something like depression and personality, and the continuum between severe and debilitating depression, and all the way out on the other hand, or perhaps having a bad day, but in the middle, many variants of increasing severity that make it so hard to distinguish between what is mental illness and what is health, what is disorder, and what's not. And we see all varieties of the kind of depression that Andrew is describing, and we treat it in a variety of ways.
Why is it that if this is a biological disease, if there's a biological basis for mental illness, would talk therapy work?
So we actually have neuroimaging evidence of this. If an individual has a particular anxiety disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, a particular part of the brain lights up on PET scan. It's kind of like a hot spot. And we know that if you treat with an appropriate SSRI, that hot spot kind of cools down. This is an experiment done by Baxter at Yale probably 15 years ago. We also know that if you treat that person with cognitive behavioral therapy, the same area cools down. So we know that the talk therapy and the chemical therapy, essentially the medication, are both effective. So how might that be? How could it work? Got to tell a little story about Eric Kandel, who was probably the only psychiatrist, I believe the only psychiatrist, who ever have won a Nobel Prize. And he won it for a series of experiments that he did with a little sea slug. So the sea slug has, I don't know, maybe 100 neurons in its entire nervous system. And so it's very easy to study. And what he discovered was that if you're looking at the nervous system of the sea slug, and you approach the sea slug with a probe, and the sea slug at first is touched by the probe and has a gill reflex and sort of jumps away from it. You do that two or three times, and the sea slug learns to jump away from the probe before the probe actually touches him. So the sea slug has learned from an environmental stimuli. Well, words are an environmental stimuli also. Now, when the sea slug learns to jump away before the probe actually touches him, if you look at what's happened inside the sea slug's nervous system, he's grown new synapses. His brain has actually modulated itself around this piece of learning. So we modulate our brains with the things that we learn. We learn many things from words. Hence, talk therapy works right alongside drug therapy, sometimes together, in what we now know is a plastic brain. We used to think the brain was static once we got to 25 or 30 years old, but it's just not true. And psychotherapy produces modulation in the brain, which produces changes in our behavior, changes in our feeling, and changes in our thinking.
A lot of people in our audience want to make sure we spend some time talking about some of the personal stories that both Kay and Andrew have written about. And I'd like to go to you, Andrew, and talk a bit about depression from your standpoint, maybe with a story of something in your life that happened that very distinctly stands out to you as something that depression has caused, that depression has wrought, that maybe some people in this audience would not understand if you were not to tell them.
Well, I would really begin by describing my initial episode of depression, which came in 1994. I was publishing a novel. It was a novel that I liked and that I'd spent a lot of time working on. I had always wanted to publish a novel. And I found I wasn't very interested in what happened as it came out or how people were responding to it. And I was surprised that I wasn't getting more pleasure out of the experience, but I didn't think much of it. And then in the months that followed that, I began finding myself losing a sense of interest in things. I would come in and hear the messages on my answering machine, back in the days of answering machines. And instead of thinking, oh, how wonderful, my friends wanted to get in touch, I would think, that's an awful lot of people to have to call back. It's an awful lot of people to have to respond to. And then everything began to just seem difficult. And I found myself going out less and interacting less and leaving my room less. And eventually the most ordinary things began to feel impossible. I remember waking up and thinking I should eat lunch and thinking, but I'd have to cut the food up and put it on a plate and chew it and swallow it. And it felt like the Stations of the Cross. And the thing that people don't always recognize is that you know when you're in a depression that it's a ridiculous experience. You know that other people are having lunch and doing all of these other things and that they aren't difficult and that people do them just fine, and yet you find yourself so physically unable to do them. The acuity of it is absolutely incredible. And I made the mistake that everyone makes of thinking, as my depression was getting worse and worse, that I was a strong person and I was going to handle it and I was going to do it without help. And then the anxiety began to set in. And if you told me I had to be depressed for the next month, I would say, as long as I know it's only a month, I can do it. But if you said I had to have really acute anxiety for the next month, I would refuse the whole thing. It was the sense all the time, like that feeling if you slip and trip before you actually hit the ground, that feeling of fear that in that instance lasts for about a second and a half, and in the instance of people suffering major anxiety can last for weeks at a time, months at a time even. And I finally got to the point at which I was feeling so terrified, but I didn't know what I was terrified of. And I remember one day waking up and thinking, I can't move. I can't get out of bed. And I almost thought I'd had a stroke. And I stared at the telephone and thought I should call and ask for help. And I lay staring at the phone for almost 5 hours, and I couldn't reach out and pick it up. And finally it rang, and I managed to answer it. And fortunately it was my father, who's a highly sympathetic person, and I said, I don't know what's wrong with me, but something is very wrong. Can you come down here? And he came down and took me in. Mm-hmm.
That feeling of not knowing what is wrong with you.
Thank you.
That feeling of not knowing what's wrong with you, but knowing that something is wrong, seems very powerful and very scary. How long did that last? How long did that type of episode last in your life?
I think that episode, essentially the period I've described, was probably about 4 months or so. Then I started treatment and medication, and then when I was beginning to feel a little better, I was so angry about what had happened and so unwilling to integrate it into my sense of who I was. And I had a sort of long period before I got to be fully functional again. I would say another 2 or 3 months at least. And then I thought, okay, I'm all better now. And I stopped the medication and I largely withdrew from the therapy. And then I relapsed. And then I went back to everything and I got better. And finally, after about the fourth or fifth time, I thought, I can't go on doing this. And I came across the research that indicated that repeated depressive episodes actually are really bad for your brain and that they do not end well. And I thought, no, the responsible thing to do is to stay in treatment.
Kate, why does it hurt your brain to have too many of these?
Well, I think it's one of the things that's really underemphasized. And certainly, I think having been through the same going off my medication, thinking I was going to be okay and will my way through, getting sick again, getting manic again. I think that actually had I really known that my brain was going to be affected, I would have done things differently. I think it's probably the only thing that would have been persuasive to me. One of the things that we know is that if you've got a scan of somebody's brain when they've had one episode versus 8 episodes, you really want the brain on one episode. You can't keep having heart attacks without compromising your heart muscle. I mean, it's just not going to happen. You're not going to get by with it. The brain is an exquisitely sensitive chemical system, and you can't kind of mess around with it. These are things that are important. I mean, science really matters, and it really counts.
When we come back, we'll continue our conversation live from the stage of the Bushnell in Hartford and the Connecticut Forum, an honest look at mental illness. We'll take a look at stigma and what effect it has on those dealing with mental illness. It's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's hard to talk about mental illness without talking about stigma. There's the stigma of those with mental illness and the way the outside world sees them, then the stigma of having mental illness yourself, of whether or not you want to go to a doctor and have someone tell you that you have a problem. I moderated a panel discussion for the Connecticut Forum on March 7th called An Honest Look at Mental Illness. During that conversation with Andrew Solomon, Dr. Kay Redfield Jamison, and Dr. Hank Schwartz, I asked our panel of mental health experts about the stigma of mental illness.
Kay, what does stigma mean to you? I mean, how do you define that?
I really don't like the word stigma, so I'll just start from that. I think that stigma stigmatizes. I also think it's a somewhat meaningless term in the sense that it has a moral quality to it, that if you're stigmatizing something, you're doing something wrong. I guess my perspective would be it's less that you're doing something wrong, although you may be doing something wrong. It's more that perhaps you could be doing it differently and you could learn about something. And I think that if you look at the places in the history of medicine where stigma has come and gone relatively, you would look at an illness like epilepsy. You would look at cancer in the 50s. You would look at AIDS more recently. And you would say, what made the difference in how those illnesses were perceived by others? And you would say treatment, effective treatment. When you could control seizures and people could go down the street without having a seizure and being publicly humiliated and embarrassed and other people being frightened, that made a difference. When you could start treating cancers and not everyone would die from them, that made a real difference in the ability of the public to talk about them. If you look at AIDS, I mean, huge difference between the time you could treat AIDS and before the treatment of AIDS in terms of public attitudes and the attitudes of those individuals who were infected. I mean, huge difference. And I think that, in fact, in terms of destigmatizing campaigns, the single most effective destigmatizer of mental illness was a Newsweek cover of Prozac, of a pill, Prozac pill. People from that point on actually started talking a little bit more. I think people's attitudes have changed as a result of that. I think the emphasis on stigma is understandable. I just think it would be better to use the word discrimination.
I'd love your thoughts on this, Andrew.
I think that the stigma around mental illness is a result of a general perception on the part often of the people who are affected by mental illness that they are alone, and that it leads people to try to keep their mental illness a secret. It's very burdensome and exhausting having a mental illness, and it's very burdensome and exhausting keeping a secret of that scale. And when you have people who have mental illness who are trying to keep it a dark secret hidden from everyone around them, they're expending an enormous amount of energy on that secrecy that could better be expended on trying to get better. And I also think that people don't understand how ubiquitous these conditions are. And people always say to me, what's it like having been so public about having had a mental illness, do you feel like people are pointing and laughing? And what I actually experience is that everywhere I go, people say to me, I'm worried about my brother. My wife hasn't been doing very well. I've been having this problem. It's a sort of constant topic of conversation. It's sort of the family secret that everybody has, mental illness. And if it doesn't directly affect you, it affects somebody you know. And if you don't think it affects anyone you know, it's because they're not telling you.
I want to turn to where Hank and I have spent so much time this year about violence and mental illness. Are people who have severe mental illness, Hank, more violent than the general population?
You know, the data suggests that individuals with mental illness are responsible for about 3 to 5% of violent acts in the United States every year. Meaning, importantly, that 95 to 97% of violent acts are committed by people who are not mentally ill. That being said, it is true that for young men who are experiencing a first episode of psychosis, from the time that the first signs and symptoms emerge until the time that they actually enter treatment, the risk of committing a homicide is about 6 times higher than it is for the average person. So there is a small subset of people, and people read the newspapers, they hear about the symptomatology, and they equate these events with mental illness. It's important to pull back from that and remember that that is not reflective of the population of people with mental illnesses at large. In the wake of Sandy Hook, we leapt into this discussion about guns, school safety, and mental illness, as though, obviously, anybody who would commit a mass murder must be mentally ill. We all say, well, there's got to be something wrong with this person. We just don't know how to think about what that thing wrong is. It is not necessarily always mental illness.
Kay, as you've watched it, what do you think, if anything, we've learned about mental illness in America after Sandy Hook? Because, as Hank said, we leapt into a conversation that we seemed unprepared to actually have.
Many of us with mental illness and many of us who treat mental illness are a bit uncomfortable with the focus on violence. On the other hand, I think that's a discussion that should be held. I think that that's not something that should be avoided. And I think that one of the problems with stigmatizing illness is that you don't talk about all aspects of risks and things associated with that illness. So I think that one of the things that's come out of it is that the White House really got energized, and the National Institute of Mental Health was given a very specific set of directives at the executive order level about mental illness. That was something that I haven't seen for a very, very long time. I think that's a very good thing. One of the things that I think a lot of us would love to see more emphasis on is on suicide. It's not that there isn't an increased risk of violence in mental illness, in certain kinds of mental illness, because there is. But I think that the real risk of death is suicide. And there are 35,000 suicides a year, and most of those are in young people, 95% of whom have mental illness. So if you're talking about disproportionate representation, that's where the deaths that occur in this country that are preventable occur. And they're associated with one of three or four mental illnesses, primarily bipolar illness and depression, but also schizophrenia has a very high suicide rate. And to me, the public doesn't talk about that enough. And I think that the Army has been very good about bringing this to the public attention, and I think have done a great job in terms of trying to deal with a very bad problem. But that would be something I would like to see come out in the public discussion more.
I think there's an interesting question also about the legal definition of insanity and the medical definition of insanity and the way that those two don't always align and how both of them align with the sort of more common use of the idea of crazy. You know, the question, I don't know, is anyone who does something like a mass shooting crazy to have done it? Certainly their thinking seems distorted and foreign to us. I think we assign those people a status as suffering from mental illnesses as a means of reassuring ourselves that normal people aren't capable of acts of terrible evil. And I think we've seen over and over again in context from Rwanda to Nazi Germany and so on and so forth that actually quite a lot of people, when social constraints are removed, are capable of acts that are terribly evil and disturbing. And it comes back, I think, in some ways to the spectrum of experience we're looking at. In the case specifically of Sandy Hook, it seems clear that Adam Lanza had some form of autism or he had been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, but he also appears to have had psychopathy. And is psychopathy a mental illness? And is there a relationship between the autism and the psychopathy? And are the deficits in cognitive empathy that are characteristic of autism, in which people are not able to process the complex manifestations of emotion in other people, related to the lack of empathy that is characteristic of psychopaths? I mean, I think this is all very murky territory. I do think, though, that as Kay has said, we should consider not only the danger that people with mental illnesses pose to others, but also the enormous danger that they pose to themselves, and recognize that as an equal tragedy.
We had a few questions, and maybe you can continue, Kay, connections between addictions, alcoholism, drug addictions, and mental illness. Just Tell us a bit more about how strong those connections are.
They're really strong. In the case of bipolar illness, 60% of people with bipolar illness will have a history of alcohol and or drug abuse. It's the largest co-occurrence of substance abuse and a major mental illness. So it's very seldom that you have somebody who's completely uncomplicated by that, and you've got to deal with both of those issues at the same time. It's not enough just to treat the mental illness. It's not enough to just treat the substance abuse. You've got to treat both at the same time.
Hank, would you like to say more on that? Because I think that's something that many people in their families deal with on one level or another.
Yeah, and it's also something that illustrates, again, the fractured nature of our mental health substance abuse system. You know, we have substance abuse facilities and we have psychiatric hospitals. And while we try to work and come together, the culture of the substance abuse clinical community is different from the culture of the psychiatric mental health community, and that we often don't get that right. The problem for people in families really is separating out. I mean, substance abuse can mask the development of many mental illnesses, that is another complication makes knowing what to do for your family member that much harder.
What are we supposed to make of the increased diagnoses, say, in particular, with kids of ADHD, autism, eating disorders? We certainly hear a lot in the news about autism being more prevalent. Are these more prevalent today, and what should we make of it?
Well, the first fact that we have is that they're more frequently diagnosed today. So then we have to ask, well, are we over-diagnosing, or are because we're more aware of these conditions, or are these conditions on the increase? I'm not sure it's always possible to discriminate the right answer to that. I think that, in my view and my reading of the literature, that depressive disorders are on the increase. ADHD would get to Kay's discussion earlier of the influence of big pharma on how we diagnose. The advent of effective ADHD medications and their promotion by pharmaceutical companies has definitely had an influence on our thinking and diagnosing. And yet, but that does not mean that ADHD may not be on the rise. You know, with regard to autism, it's important to think it was only in the 1940s that we identified autism as a syndrome. It took a generation for that identification to the knowledge base for that identification to extend kind of uniformly to clinicians in the behavioral health, pediatric and development, child development specialties. So, of course, during a period like that, as people learn more about autism, we're going to identify more cases. And have we gotten to the point where that's still happening, or the diagnosis, particularly of people on the in the Asperger's more mild version, is that really increasing, or has it in some way become the diagnosis that's in vogue? I don't think we can definitively determine. We can't leave tonight without mentioning trauma. And at first, we may think of post-traumatic stress disorder, which actually most people are probably somewhat familiar with. It's occupied so much of our time and attention, particularly with returning veterans. But trauma itself and the identification of trauma underlies depression and anxiety disorders, and what I would call psychological conditions that perhaps don't qualify for a psychiatric diagnosis, but which really reshapes the lives of young people when trauma goes undetected, unrecognized, and is unaddressed. And trauma-informed care, creating a cadre of clinicians throughout our country who really are aware of trauma, identify it, and address it, is going to be, is already a critical part of effective care.
Andrew, some believe that there is no medical proof of mental illness, but rather what we diagnose as mental illness is the result of trauma or other factors. What do you say when people say this to you?
Well, I think in a way, to pick up on this idea that talk therapy works the same way medications do, that to say something isn't an illness because it's the outgrowth of traumatic experiences is naive. I think many mental illnesses reflect a genetic vulnerability that gets triggered by external circumstances. So there are probably some people who have got a stronger predisposition toward illness and would almost certainly develop it no matter what their experiences were. And there are other people for whom experiences may play a more significant role. And we can't come up with some kind of universal formula of exactly what the proportion is of predisposition and what happens outside. There was some interesting work that was done at Yale in which they were looking at the development of certain kinds of psychopathology, and they discovered that people who had a given gene and were not exposed to early childhood trauma did not become psychopathic, that people who did not have that gene did not tend to become psychopathic in this sample, whether they were subjected to abusive behavior or not, but that people who had the gene and were exposed to abusive behavior were 10 times as likely as control populations to develop psychopathy, which indicates that that gene, there were some problems with the experiment, but it indicates that effectively they were looking at a genetic vulnerability, and that that vulnerability then interacted with the world.
So there's a form of genetics that was really developed over the last 20 years known as epigenetics. And epigenetics tells us that environmental influences and stimuli actually turn genes on and can turn genes off. You know, we used to think, well, we're born with a set of genes, and that's what is going to dictate the course of our lives. And yet, two identical twins may have the genetics for schizophrenia, and one will develop it and the other not. But the one who has not developed it may develop it with the right environmental stimuli, turning on the genes which he's always had, which is another way in which, by the way, we don't know the ways that all environmental stimuli, even words, may turn on various elements of our genetic loading, and so influence either the onset or the diminution of illness.
This question reads, there are times when a patient has perceived a danger to him or herself or others. How do we balance that with the rights of the patient? How do we balance the rights of those around the patient with the rights of the patient themselves? Kay, what do you think?
Well, it's a painful issue. Anyone who's had to commit somebody against their will know that, whether it's a family member or as a professional. That's a terribly difficult call, usually, not always. I think a couple things. One thing is I'm a great advocate of advanced directives, and by that I mean if you know that you have a psychiatric illness, to sit down with your doctor and family members and draw up plans for what you would like to have happen to you if you get sick again, in my case if I got manic again or if I got suicidally depressed again. And to do this when you're at the top of your game, in other words, when you're thinking best and when you're most rational and when it's not an emergency, because what we know is when it's an emergency, that just ratchets up everything, the emotions and thinking. And then say, you know, this is, I would agree to commitment, even though if when I'm sick I say I don't want commitment, I agree to commitment. I would like ECT or I would not. I would like these medications. I would like this doctor. In my case, I say I want to be on Meyer 4 at Johns Hopkins treated by the following doctors. And I mean, it's terribly specific. You know, I have a very specific set of requests. And then I give that to my husband. It's not that it's legally binding, because it's not always legally binding, but what it does is give a moral authority to my doctors and to my husband, so because it is a difficult call. And there are just a lot of times when people have to be put in the hospital because they're acutely suicidal, or because they're dangerous to other people. Nobody likes doing it, and that's what the job is. If you're a doctor and if you're a family member, get support, get education, get some knowledge of what you want done if it comes up. So try and prepare in advance.
There's another question here about patients' rights. In Connecticut, attorneys applying to the bar must disclose any mental health treatment, but not physical. How can we change this to no longer discourage treatment? Hank?
Well, that's an outrageous example, I think, of reaching way too far in a discriminatory fashion. I thought there was case law that established that that couldn't happen. I guess I'm mistaken. But to hold someone's capacity to practice law hostage to the possibility that they have an underlying mental illness that is treatable and controllable is overt discrimination.
But on the other hand, I think that one of the things is also clear that if you work in a hospital, you sign off on privileges forms that say, do you have a condition or an illness that might impair your judgment or ability to practice? That's a very different wording. It's much more specific. And I think it's totally legitimate. I don't mind having to answer that question. I think that's fair. You don't have a right to practice. It is a privilege. I have to have a letter to my professional board every year from my psychiatrist saying that I'm okay. You know, well, I mean, I don't like it. I think some of it's fair and some of it's not fair. But given who's out there,
yeah.
I don't know.
But I would also add that the question in the case you've described and in many other cases is whether someone is receiving treatment for a mental health disorder. It's difficult to run for political office in this country if it's possible it will be exposed that you're receiving treatment from a psychiatrist. It, for a long time, was illegal for airplane pilots to be taking antidepressants. And so far as I'm concerned, what this does is to discourage people who have ambitions in those fields from seeking treatment. And I would much rather be in a plane that is flown by a pilot on antidepressants than by a pilot with untreated depression.
Coming up, we'll continue our conversation from the stage of the Bushnell in Hartford. I hosted the Connecticut Forum on March 7th called An Honest Look at Mental Illness. When we continue a look at how our mental health system is faring today, are patients getting the care they need, what changes need to be made to make treatment more accessible and more effective? That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. Our conversation will continue with a panel of reporters and news junkies. We'll find out what's happening in the week's news and politics, and it's all coming up on the next Where We Live. Right now, we're listening back to a conversation I held at the Connecticut Forum on March 7th called An Honest Look at Mental Illness. Many have said that our mental health care system is in need of improvement, in need of becoming more robust. I sat down with panelists Andrew Solomon, Dr. Kay Redfield Jamison, and Dr. Hank Schwartz, three leading thinkers in the world of mental health, and asked them how our system is faring today.
What's the state of our mental health care system right now, Hank?
I would say nearly complete disorganization, if you think about the mega system. To give credit where credit is due, I think that Connecticut has a public mental health system that is better than most, and attempts to coordinate care for individuals who are within their domain. But then that's just, you know, their domain. And there are people who are commercially insured, who are subject to a whole other set of constraints and access issues, and no coordination between one or the other. There really isn't a mental health system. If we were to attempt to step back from the system that we have now, I think we would create a system that has the full panoply, a continuum of care, which I just had suggested earlier, from individuals who may need traditional once-a-week psychotherapy through individuals who need day hospitals and other level residential care, supportive housing, vocational care, psychosocial supports. But we can't get there when we have a commercial system of insurance that is dependent on utilization review, in which insurance companies review and have to approve every episode of care and can deny care on the basis of medical necessity, almost with impunity, so that an individual comes into an emergency department in let's say, Hartford Hospital, and who is suicidal. Our physician, who has done a suicide assessment, has to do a pre-certification review. And if the doc on the other end thinks the patient's not quite suicidal enough, may deny reimbursement for care. It happens too frequently. But even more frequently than that original pre-certification denial, the patient is admitted. Day one, two, maybe by day three, the re-review call comes in. And the patient who, let's say in this instance, the patient's a 19-year-old young woman, maybe perhaps with borderline personality disorder features, enormously fluctuating mood and affect and thoughts about suicide. And by day three, well, saying not so sure that I'm suicidal. Well, the reviewer may say that is not just further care is not justified on the basis of medical necessity. It doesn't. There is no medical necessity for further care. The reviewers, by the way, are working hired. They're either contractors or employees of the insurer. So the review is hardly independent. Another issue, commercial insurers do not pay for non-traditional elements of recovery. I think, our thoughts, for instance, about the necessity of housing for individuals who are psychotic. You have a chronically psychotic person bouncing in and out of the hospital and living in a shelter in between hospitalizations. Enlightened thinking about systems approaches to mental health care suggest it's vital to put money into stabilizing that person's housing. Okay, a Department of Mental Health can do that, and so people who are in the purview of the Department of Mental Health may get supported housing. But housing doesn't fit within the medical model of commercially insured. And so right now, today, there's absolutely no way to provide it.
It sounds, Kay, and you're nodding your head. We can talk about this as much as we want, and I think we can raise the level of people's understanding. But if these are the systems that we're dealing with, it feels, and Hank is as part of changing it as anyone, but if this is the systems we're dealing with, we won't get anywhere, it seems.
Well, the system's going to change.
System's going to change. Well, I want to hear from
you. Yes, I think the system will change, and it is one of the infuriating things about, if you're on the wards and a patient is suicidal and somebody, 300 miles away who hasn't a clue one way or another says, no, they've got to go home, and you say, well, it's on your head. I mean, it's a completely insane and unfair system. My husband's a cardiologist at Hopkins, and, the thought that the insurers would tell him that one of his patients in the ICU had to go home is just, aside from the fact that he would be down their throats, it just doesn't happen. And that's where you see the discrimination and the stigma. Right. And I think what will change is eventually when enough people are public, like Andrew said, I think when enough people have had it, and one of the things that I always say when I go to an advocacy meeting is you are first and foremost, for the purposes here, voters. Vote. Ask the people who represent you. And I think that this is one of the things that's been very effective with breast cancer and with AIDS is that people have said, go out and use political power. Because that's how systems change. Systems don't change on the basis of goodwill. They change on the basis of people having had it, uniting and coming up with systematic plans. And I think that that's what's going to happen. And I think that is what's happening, is that incrementally, far too slowly, glacially, but things are changing.
We're almost out of time. And this sort of gets us in an area that I'd like to ask you all to talk about a bit. And I know, Hank, you're passionate about this topic and you've written about it. This is a big problem to solve. And sometimes in America, we have big problems and we spend a lot of money on them. And sometimes in America, we have big problems and we don't. And this seems like a problem that we throw pennies on the dollar at. Give me a sense of what you think we need to do as a nation to solve some of these issues, to just do better research, to help more people clinically, to just do more good in this world. What would we need to do?
We need to do more research at the basic science level. Imagine what we spend on cancer and what we spend on heart disease and in comparison to what we spend on mental illness. It is pathetically low. And yet, the World Health Organization notes that mental disorders and substance abuse are the single largest cause of disability worldwide. Now, disability is measured as an economic feature or aspect. So we're talking dollars lost from the workplace and from home life. It deserves more attention.
Okay.
Well, I completely agree. I think in general you can sort of divide it up into what do we do about the problem of mental illness for the future? And what do we do about people who have it now or who have it in their families? Infinitely more money has to go into research. I mean, that is where treatment is going to come from. It's going to be where the fundamental understanding of the brain comes from. I would also say that there are a whole group of other problems that have to do with people who live with mental illness every day. How do you get people into treatment who don't think they need treatment? And the second one is, once they're in treatment, how do you keep them in treatment? How do you deal with the problem of an 18-year-old who's probably at high risk for suicide and really bad illness who will not take his medicine? So those are issues that are really not sexy to study, and yet they determine so much of the outcome because we have treatments now that work. So the question is, how do we make it more effective and more compassionate system? Hopkins, for example, has one of our young psychiatrists has been doing this for years in the Baltimore public and private school system, and now it's an international program of just going out and teaching teachers, high school students, middle school students, and their parents about the signs of depression, the symptoms of depression. These are the symptoms. This is treatable. It's not uncommon, and that's low cost. And it affects a lot of people.
And Andrew, quickly, I'll give you the last word on this because I'd love to hear your thoughts.
I would begin by saying that I feel incredibly grateful to live now. I take a constellation of medications. They have allowed me to have an incredibly rich and rewarding and joyful life in many ways. It still has its ups and downs. They require a lot of management. I hate taking them. They're expensive, and they have a lot of side effects, and I hope that people a generation from now will look back at what I have taken and say, oh my God, how primitive, how could you ever have endured that?
Exactly.
But having said that, I think if I had lived 50 or 60 or 100 years earlier, I think of what a reduced life I would have had to have, and I feel so grateful for what we have now. In terms of economic priorities, therefore, I think there are two. One is to develop medications which are equally effective with fewer side effects, or indeed medications which are more effective or effective for more people. But I also think that we have a lot of powerful and effective treatments for mental illnesses, and that quite a small proportion of people who have mental illnesses are receiving adequate, competent, full treatment. And I think that what we need to do is to ensure that the treatments we have are available to the broadest possible population, and that the ability to get good treatment is not restrained to a small group of highly educated people who happen to have the privilege and the wherewithal to obtain the services and to obtain the quality of treatment they require.
Thanks to Andrew Solomon, Kay Redfield Jamison, and Hank Schwartz for a great conversation on the stage at the Bushnell in Hartford. Thanks also to Richard and Doris Sugarman, Jamie Daniel, and the entire Connecticut Forum family for putting on this very important panel discussion. Their next forum is coming up on May 3rd. It's called Nerdfest. You can go to ctforum.org to find out more information. If you're interested in more of today's discussion about mental illness, you can watch tonight on CPTV. Where We Live is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.